Many things will never be the same, not since Google became a verb. Take bickering over trivial facts. That certainly lost some steam. Stuff like name-dropping Martin Van Buren's running mate is no longer a feat for the strictly geeky. And then there's relationships. Thinking of hiring someone or dating them? You know where to punch their name in first. In so many ways, information comes fast and cheap today. And tomorrow, you might be able to do all this Googling from within your own dear brain, using a piece of neuromedia. But does all this information lead to knowledge? And where does wisdom and human understanding figure into the vastness of cyberspace? These are a few of the many big questions lined up for our next guest. His new book is called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Michael Patrick Lynch is a professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut and a frequent contributor to the New York Times. The Internet of Us is the latest of 7 books he's either written or edited. Michael Patrick Lynch, welcome to The Exchange.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So how does knowledge differ from wisdom, if we can just cut right to it?
So I think the main difference between the sort of ordinary knowledge we might acquire by, you know, Googling or perhaps even picking up a book and or asking somebody on the street, you know, where the restaurant we're looking for is, and a sort of deeper understanding, which is what I think of as related to wisdom, is that a deeper understanding, deeper types of knowledge, are not just don't involve just accessing simple facts or lists of facts. They, when we understand in this deeper sense, we see the relationship between facts. We see how to connect the dots, as we sometimes say. And to put that a little bit more exactly, what we're actually doing is seeing why things are the case or how the case. And to do that, we have to actually engage our creative mind and recognize certain relationships of dependency that obtain between the facts out in the world. We see how things fit together.
And so the subtitle of your book gives a little bit away of where we're going with this, knowing more and understanding less in the age of big data. How do you see that manifest in human behaviors, where people know a bunch of stuff, but they're not exhibiting the traits of a deeply understanding human being?
Well, I think, and you mentioned this in the intro, I think that we're all familiar now with the fact that we have an incredible amount of information and, in some ways, knowledge, and some, if we're lucky, knowledge, at our fingertips, right, in our smartphones. And as a result, that sometimes makes us, I think, nowadays, prone to a type of overconfidence about knowledge. We think that because we have so much information right at our fingertips, we're always actually better situated to also have this deeper understanding. But that's not often the case, because the sorts of the type of information that we're able to access most of the time online is not the sort of information that all by itself necessarily allows us to engage in this more creative act of grasping these relationships, these hidden relationships between the facts. For that, we have to often, you know, get up out of our chair and actually engage with the world, even if that's engagement and sometimes online. But to engage in a particular way, in a reflective way, in a way that's sensitive to the hard questions of whether the source we're consulting is actually as accurate as we might think that it is.
Can you give an example of that kind of engagement from your
own
life?
Sure. So one example that I think is particularly relevant for us, those of us who live this digital form of life, which I certainly do, is when you Google something. We all know about Google Complete, even if you don't know the name. Google Complete is the name of the program that allows Google to essentially finish our sentences for us.
Mm-hmm.
When we type something into the online, such as climate change, it will helpfully suggest other words that we might be hoping to finish that search with. And if you do, for example, if you type in climate change, you might find climate change hoax comes up first, or climate change facts might come down a little bit, or climate change theory, climate change impact, things like that. Those suggestions, as many of your listeners I'm sure know, are due to the fact that other people have expressed certain preferences in their searches before and right now, even as you're doing it online. In other words, analytics allows us to sift through all the searches that are going on, and that impacts the sorts of searches we're going to make in a minute. So that when you're working through Google, it's not like consulting a library, except maybe perhaps a more Borgesian library, like a library which the volumes actually change as you walk down the shelves to meet your preferences. Now, why that can be a sort of barrier to this deeper understanding, because and essentially when we're searching online, the results that we're getting are being guided by the views of others and ourselves in the past. And that can bring with it all sorts of biases and prejudices that we might not be aware of. And if we're not aware that our searches, and not just our searches, but our interactions with all sorts of apps and rating systems are being guided by these biases, possibly being distorted by these biases and prejudices, that can be a real barrier to grasping any sort of deeper knowledge and seeing how things really fit together as opposed to how we would like them to be or we imagine them to be.
So, Michael, are you a Luddite? Is this an anti-technology book?
It's definitely not. I think of this book as, I mean, first of all, I have more computers and devices than I'd care to admit. I'm somebody who's very much hooked into the, as I called it, the digital form of life that I think the rest of us are. The question that I'm interested in, it's true that philosophers throughout history have sometimes expressed skepticism about technology. You know, Plato sniffed at the idea of the written word and so forth, and Descartes worried that, you know, there were too many books being published, nobody could keep up with it. But that's not the sort of point that I'm making. The point I'm making is more like this analogy. Look, cars, right, get us where we want to go. We fell in love with them. We really valued them. But cars have had an unfortunate bad side effect with the climate.
Right.
And so what we need to do is just think about what we're doing with technology, not abandon it, but try to improve it in a way that gets us where we want to go.
A lot more critical thinking to do about information technology with Michael Patrick Lynch. His book is called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. I'm Emily Curitan. This is the Jefferson Exchange. We will be back after a short break, hopefully with your comments and phone calls. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Patrick Lynch, our guest right now. He's the author of The Internet of Us. It is a sweeping philosophical look at information technology. I hope you'll join the discussion, 800-838-3760, or online on our Facebook page, or you can email us, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, right before the break, you were talking, you mentioned the moral implication of cars and how it goes beyond the utility of the thing, just like the implications of the internet go beyond its use to us. Can you talk about where we're headed there, specifically neuromedia?
So, in the book, I talk about this brief remark that Larry Page, who's the Google CEO, made a couple years ago now, where he said at one point, he hopes that we'll be able to have an implant in our brain that will allow us to, when we just think of a question, to get the answer. In other words, what he's thinking about is what I call neuromedia, which is the idea that we could shrink the capacities or capabilities of our smartphone to the degree to which it's hooked up to our neural net directly. And that's a really, really, you know, for somebody like myself who's interested in technology, that's sort of an exciting thought. In many ways, it would be really amazing to imagine a society where we were able to communicate in this way. We'd be able to communicate, in a sense, via the internet, brain to brain. We would be able to download information. There would be all sorts of coordinated activities would be so much easier to do because we would be able to communicate in such a rapid fashion, and we'd have access to so much information in ways that would be almost like remembering it. But the problem with that is that we can imagine that people would embrace this technology for all sorts of reasons, but we sometimes, because it would be so convenient and, as I said, so amazing in certain ways. But we also can imagine that we might overlook the issues that it would bring with it, such as the challenges to privacy that comes with more deep integration of technology in our lives. We already see that now. We don't need neuro media to realize that privacy is under threat because of our uses of technology and our embrace of technology. And of course, coordinated activities are going to get easier, but some of those coordinated activities like war might not be things we really want to make easier. And then on top of that, if we imagine in the book, I begin with what thing philosophers like to call a thought experiment, which is just an imaginary story. Imagine this society existing with this technology for couple generations, and then suddenly the server's going down, and that society no longer being able to use this implant. They'd still have access to information in the old way. They could dust off laptops, maybe break out a book or two, but I think it would be a great disaster for this society because they would become, after a couple generations, you would imagine, very dependent on this particular way of accessing information. The ways in which we access information change us. And we can imagine that for that society, it would be a little bit like going blind.
Yeah.
And that, I think, should give us pause because in some ways now, we're already deeply integrated. Our lives are deeply integrated with technology. So we don't even notice how often, I think, that most of us are consulting and using the internet and digital devices. And again, I'm not complaining about that. I do that all the time, every day, many, many, many times a day, just like everyone else. We need to think about the ways in which accessing information in this way might be changing us.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Kara and Eugene on the line. Kara, welcome, or Cara, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, so this is slightly related. I'm sorry, it's a little slightly off topic, but I've noticed that, especially maybe generation maybe 30 and younger, maybe everybody, because people have their cell phones with them in public, and they can access their private lives, or they can access this private world of their personal lives, in a public setting, at work, anywhere, on the bus, anywhere, it constantly disrupts their ability to really engage in common physical space with the public in a meaningful way, the way that you used to chat with strangers and stuff. So it seems to me that there's also an issue of, because we were breaking up the ability to connect in a public space with strangers, that is also affecting how we view, you know, what knowledge is important.
Right. Yeah, that's great. I think so. That's one of the things that I do talk about in the book. And let me just note that this is a worry that's been around for a while, not just about this sort of technology, but about how humans interact. In the 1940s, the philosopher Karl Popper said he could imagine a society in the future. He thought that society was coming where men and women, he said, would live in isolated cubicles and communicate only by machines. And then he also said, and drive around in cars that would drive themselves, which is sort of
pretty much called it.
Right?
Yeah, pretty much called it.
I mean, but, you know, to your point, exactly, we've all experienced this. And what Popper said is that society is going to be a sort of alienated society from itself. And we do, you know, I think that is a worry that a lot of us have. That the common space that you're talking about, the space where we exchange ideas, has morphed. Now, I would say it hasn't gone away. It's just that, as you noted, we're engaging the common spaces that we engage with are spaces that we now monitor and curate in a way that is less spontaneous than it used to be. And partly that's due to the fact that, of course, we can create online communities and common spaces that we interact with that are filled with sort of self-selecting groups of like-minded people. And that's great in many ways. It can lead to all sorts of productive conversations, but it can also lead to us living in little isolated information bubbles, right, where we're not really interacting with people that have substantively different views than our own.
Uh-huh.
And I think as far as the health of the democracy is concerned, that's a very dangerous thing.
Yeah, could we talk about reason in a philosophical sense then, for pausing there, this idea that, you know, when you Google things or when you poke around on the internet, oftentimes you're not accessing this cornucopia of diverse views. You're almost just kind of reinforcing whatever nugget you started with. Can you talk about research that supports that and how that might answer the question of whether or not the internet makes us more or less reasonable?
Well, I think that's exactly right, and that we are, as I was saying, as well. When we're online, we're in these little information bubbles, and that fact is sort of encouraging a tendency that human beings, psychologists have been telling us for a long time. Human beings are very prone, tend to confirmation bias. And implicit biases of all sorts. We tend to have the want to believe whatever opinion already fits what we already think is true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not new. That's human beings have always probably been like that. I'm sure they have. But what the internet does is makes, as you said, makes that incredibly easy. So it heightens that. Because we are able to, as I said, curate and select our own groups of our own bubble of information. And I think where that gets us to, the worrying part is, on that, is that it gets us to a point where we no longer have a common set of reasons to which we can appeal to decide what's true and what's false. In other words, right now in our culture, we see this in the presidential election, that disagreements are not just about values, and they're not just about the facts. Disagreements now go so deep as to go down to the level of disagreeing over whose source for figuring out what the facts are is reliable. In other words, whose methods for figuring out what's true or false is reliable. And once we get down to that level of disagreement, it's really hard to know how we're going to climb back up any sort of common set of reasons, because if you challenge me and I on my sources and I try to defend them, well, I'm going to try to defend them probably by appealing to my sources and methods. But those are, of course, the very things that are up for challenge. And that's partly a reflection of the fact that, of course, those of us on the left read certain blogs and consult certain, are in certain circles of friends, and those on the right consult different news sources and different blogs. And that's led to sort of this very corrosive, I think, situation that we're in right now. It certainly contributed to it. So that's the sense in which I think the internet is contributing to us being less and less reasonable.
We're talking with Michael Patrick Lynch. He's the author of The Internet of Us. It's about knowing more and understanding less in the age of big data. I'm Emily Curitan. You're invited to take part in this discussion, 800-838-3760, or email us, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, I got a question here from our associate producer, Megan. It dovetails with one on my list for you. She wants to know, where does corporate authoritarianism fit in? I might phrase it, you know, what are the implications of the same companies controlling both access to data and the extraction of knowledge from that data?
The implications are worrying.
All right. Do go on.
Let me expand.
Yeah.
So, look, you know, Chomsky in the 80s wrote a book called Manufacturing Consent. And in that book, he talked about the fact that, you know, at the time, the big three networks, he said, were controlling information distribution and acquisition in the country. And they were manufacturing a sort of political consent. I mean, right now, things, of course, have radically changed. When we talk about the media now, we're really actually talking about a diverse group of companies, but also we're talking about ourselves. We're talking about right now Twitter accounts like @RealDonaldTrump act as the media for lots of people. So the thing that is actually manufacturing consent more and more now is the way the companies that allow us to navigate that world of the internet, that sort of control the ebb and flow of information on the internet, things like Google and Facebook and Twitter. They're not directly controlling the content, but they are controlling how we interact with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that we need to be aware of, because as those companies alter, let's say, their privacy policies, and allow other companies to use your information to sell you things and to get sorts of other sorts of ideas across in front of your screen, your viewpoint on the world can subtly shift. What you value can be affected, obviously, by the sorts of things that you see and digest online. And the sorts of things that you see and digest online come from that content is coming from the spigot of not just Google, but the other large online companies that affect the flow and ebb and flow of information, as I said.
So as a philosopher, why does privacy or consent matter?
So privacy, I think, matters for two obvious reasons. It's the most obvious is that if you invade my privacy online or off, you might do something with the information you get that could harm me in some way. And, you know, that's we worry about, in other words, somebody stealing our bank information,
mm-hmm.
draining our accounts. So that's the obvious sense in which, most obvious sense in which we all value our privacy online and off. The deeper reason is that my privacy of information is connected to my autonomy, my freedom as an individual with regard to my decision-making. Think of a doctor who might... If a doctor gives you a drug without your consent, they've made a certain decision of yours moot. They've taken away the question of whether you should take the drug or not from you and made that decision for you. If I hack into your iPhone and get the content on there, I'm making a certain decision for you. I'm taking away your consent, your autonomy, your ability to decide for yourself whether you want to share that information or not. And that's what's really worrying about it. And the reason that second point is so important is because that shows that there's something wrong with invading our privacy, hacking into our iPhones, for example, even if, right, the information the person doing that has good intentions, or even if they go on not to do anything bad with the information, do you see? It's just wrong in principle, in the same way that, let's say, administering a drug to you without your consent is wrong in principle, other things being equal.
So intentions do matter, or can we come up with a sort of an ethical framework for, you know, for what we put out there and what and how we interact with the internet, but also how the internet interacts back with us? Is that framework existent? Are there examples of it that are working in the world and making people happier, healthier, more productive?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it is the case that, for example, the EU has made some good steps forward with not just simplifying the idea of privacy policies, but also making it possible for people, at least in theory, to scrub clean their data trail.
Yeah.
I think that legislation is a good step forward that does not exist in the United States as of yet. I think we have a long way to go, however, on these matters, because there are really difficult challenges facing everyone. This includes EU, the U.S., everybody. And that's one of those big challenges is that right now it's really difficult to, as a consumer, or to control or have any sense of control of the information that you release online.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about the fact that your phone right now, as we're speaking, is trailing little ones and zeros of data, like little sparks behind it, right? As the various apps on my phone and your phone are using your location and tracking the what's happening to you as you move around the physical environment and the virtual environment. And that information is not information that we really are, the information that's extracted from that data is not information we're even really aware of most of the time. And so the idea of being able to control your information, as a lot of privacy experts talk about, is increasingly seems to be an idea which is under threat just because of the fact that there's so much that I'm releasing online that I'm not even aware of.
So, Michael, with about a minute or so left in our interview here, I want to ask you, what are the questions you ask yourself when you encounter a new use for information technology?
The question that I think I always find myself asking is this going to make my life better now? And in conjunction with that, is it going to make everyone's life better if we were all to use it in a way that was just habitual? The thing we need to ask about technology is just like, go back to the car metaphor. We think about right when the cars became prevalent. What should we have asked? Well, we should have asked, can this get us where we want to go? Yes. Can it make my life better? Sure, it gives me more independence. But what if everybody uses it? And what if we all use it to such a degree that we forget that we're even using it, that in a sense it just becomes part of our life? Will it still have good implications then? That's what we need to ask ourselves about cars or iPhones or any other technology like neuromedia that might one day come down the pike.
Those questions you just laid out, they actually spark a whole bunch of other questions in my mind. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, Michael Patrick Lynch, author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.